This is my nightlife went progressively later.
Well, I noticed that morning I was there. Not everybody was there yet.
Many were present. Many were not there. That's pretty common. And the worst thing was Friday night was even later than Thursday night. It's all about making connections.
Yeah, I got it.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the regular meeting of the Forest Practices Board to order. As usual, we have a very busy agenda today, so I would like to ask everyone's indulgence to keep things moving, please, today. We've got a long way to go. As we all know, we only get 4 meetings a year now, so we need to make the most of them. And I'm sure for board members looking at the agenda, you see that there's a lot of work that we have to get done today. So I'd like to welcome everybody to Olympia. And to make introductions, I'd like to start on my left, please. Board member introductions, please.
Norm Schaaf, general public member.
Dave Summers, counties.
Tom Davis, Department of Agriculture.
Sherry Fox, representing the independent contract logger.
Mark Calhoun, Department of Commerce.
Good morning, everybody. Tom Lorey, Department of Ecology.
Peter Goldmark, Commissioner of Public Lands.
Paula Swedeen, General Public Member.
Bill Little, Timber Products Unions.
Good morning, I'm Dave Herrera, General Public Member.
Doug Stinson, General Public Member, Small Landowner.
Anna Jackson, Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Thank you, members of the board, for that. And then moving on to our first item on this morning's agenda is a safety briefing. Patricia?
Thank you. Good morning and welcome to the Natural Resources Building. In the event of a fire, alarms will sound and flash. Please leave this room using the double doors in the front of the room. And in the event of an earthquake, alarms may not sound and flash. In the event of an earthquake, please drop to the floor and cover your head as best as you can or go under a table. After the shaking has stopped, leave this room using the double doors in the front of the room. In the event of any evacuation of the building, staff will lead you out of the building using the double doors in the front of the room and moving away from the building towards Jefferson Street. There, DNR employees are trained and equipped to assist you in checking in and responding to emergencies. At this time, I ask that you silence all noise-making devices you have. Thank you.
Thank you, Patricia. Moving on then to the next item on this morning's agenda is approval of the minutes from the February regular meeting. These minutes have been mailed to members of the board and the public. What are your wishes with these minutes, please, board?
I'll make the motion that we accept.
Okay, we have a motion to approve the minutes.
Second.
Thank you. The motion is properly supported. Discussion on the motion. We'll call for a vote. All those in favor of approval of the minutes, raise your hand, please. Thank you. That's unanimous. Thank you, members of the board. The next item on this morning's agenda is a report from the chair. I think we all know, I'm reflecting back on the legislative session, that it's important to note is not yet complete. We all know that many of us have worked hard on during the legislative session, and although not everything is complete, there have been a number of significant accomplishments The first thing I would note that I'm sure members of this board would are interested in is a piece of FREP legislation reform. I want to thank Board Member Fox for her leadership and for her help and collaboration with members of my staff and many others who helped get this piece of legislation passed and signed into law now by the governor. It's a major reform piece for a very important program. And I think is one of the few pieces of legislation that I'm aware of that passed unanimously in both chambers. So took a lot of hard work to get there, but it was very successful. In addition, another piece of legislation that has received a tremendous amount of work on the part of not only DNR, but also Fish and Wildlife and the Office of the Governor is a FPA-HPA bill, which is very ambitious in the sense that it sets fees on HPAs and makes major policy adjustments there. And also contemplates combining FPAs and HPAs in the forested environment to make one permit for landowners instead of having to get two permits. Also with some significant policy changes and also putting in place some modest fees, a modest fee increase to go along with that. This piece of legislation is currently, from my last information, in Senate Ways and Means. The governor's office has been working this piece of legislation exhaustively and very collaboratively, and I think has made significant progress, yet it's not clear if there is enough support to move the bill. So at the current time, the HPA component of the bill is receiving considerable work. So there one other piece of legislation which my office sponsored and which is now signed into law as well is a new tool, if you will, for conserving forested lands called a community forest trust. Again, it's my hope that this bill can add to another policy opportunity to make sure that we keep our forested lands working and in forest cover. So it's been a busy legislative session. I think we all know the state budget is not complete yet, and you can tell from looking at the paper most any day that there's some major issues that are yet to be resolved in the legislature. We all know that there will be budgetary reductions shared by the natural resource agencies, including DNR. Today, as promised, the division will have a Forest Practices Compliance Action Plan. You may recall in February when the compliance report came out, I tasked staff with coming back at our next meeting, that is today, with a plan as how to address the compliance issues raised in the report. And in addition, one other notable thing today, the Cultural Resources Committee has been working very diligently, and you will see the results of its hard work today as it comes back with a charter and name change proposal for your consideration. So there's been a lot of work going on within the Forest Practices Division, a lot of time and attention. I want to compliment the staff for their diligent efforts during the legislative session, not yet complete, but has gotten us as far as we are today in a very engaged manner, and people have been working hard representing the agency, trying to achieve some significant policy objectives in the course of a very difficult session. So my thanks to DNR staff and Forest Practices staff in particular for their hard work during this session. And that completes my report to the board. Moving on then to the next item is an opportunity for public comment. This time is allowed for public comment on general board topics. Comments on any board action item that will occur later in the meeting will be allowed prior to that action being taken. So again, I will ask members of the public who wish to comment today to make sure that they attune their comments to the appropriate time slot. And I will again encourage members of the public, when they do make comment today, to please observe the 3-minute time allotment. There are 6 people who've signed up to make comment during this general period. I'll call on the first, Ken Miller. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning. Morning, Commissioner and members of the board. For the record, as you know, I'm Ken Miller, a small family forest owner of about 100 acres of timberland. I'm one of the landowner representatives on the Small Landowner Advisory Committee. Landowners have not been able to be part of the ongoing discussions about the low-impact template we presented for consideration several months ago, so I'm very anxious to hear Mark Engel's comments today on the agenda. I have been very encouraged by what I've been hearing in the way of conceptual support from all the agency folks. I'm a little worried about the rumors that some without forestry training may be reluctant to buy into the best management practices on the thinning prescriptions. But again, hopefully Mark will shed more light on this if in fact that is a real issue. I'd like to remind the Forest Practice Board that all agency and all agency folks that this draft template has very low, if any, substantive landscape level risks, as indicated in several pages of the template language. We designed the prescriptions to avoid all previously unacceptable water and fish risks. Additionally, I would like to remind all that the template, rather than the hard to correct rule as a template, it can be changed with only one Forest Practice Board meeting if the prescriptions prove to actually create real harm. This template is the last opportunity to create meaningful opportunities for smalls to manage more effectively in smaller, low-impact ways promised in our existing RCWs and WACs. I urge all Forest Practice Board members to keep an eye on the process to ensure this effort doesn't get bogged down in bureaucratic minutiae that loses sight of the significance and promise of this effort. I also hope you will reserve time at the next Forest Practice Board meeting for a panel discussion of any remaining issues at that time. The discussion could be a precursor to the Forest Practice Board adoption of a significant template option for smalls who have mostly given up on forest and fish policy as a vehicle to achieve the promises of forest and fish. Thank you, Commissioner Goldmark, for your personal interest and support of this this effort, and thanks also to all the agency folks that I know have been working very hard to work out something that's helpful. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken. Cindy Mitchell. Morning, Cindy.
Good morning, Commissioner and board members. Thank you for allowing me to present today. My name is Cindy Mitchell. I'm with the Washington Forest Protection Association, and we represent 4 million acres of working forests in Washington State. Today I'm making a presentation by one of our members, Rainier Timberland, that joined the association in 1939. They were unable to be here today because they're participating in their third-party audit through the Sustainable Forestry Initiative. What we'd like to do is talk a little bit about what's going on in the forest besides timber harvesting. And this year, Rainier just completed planting of its 2 millionth seedling, and we know that forest lands were planted after harvest, but what you may not know is that DNR was actually an early adopter and leader in modern reforestation practices. 75 years ago, there was a nursery in near Oakville that planted 2,000 seedlings for the early Capitol Forest forest, and that was described as the state's first important reforestation project. Rainier does purchase some of these timberlands today, and maybe you'd be purchasing the original seedlings that were planted 75 years ago. Now, Rainier is completing its planting and moving into silvicultural activities like pre-commercial thinning, fertilizer, weed control, including some invasive species management. The engineering crews are also gearing up to do their RMAP work and new road construction. All of those activities are creating jobs, tax revenues, and for local and state governments. Rainier did recently meet with the Department of Natural Resources and Ecology to look at their best management practices for road maintenance and construction. This is resulting in improved water quality and also more consistent log deliveries to local mills for employment for timber workers. And speaking of employment, the governor's vision for the Cosmopolis Mill has to start back up has come true with the first pulp coming off of the machine, creating many jobs in Green Grays Harbor. This has increased the demand for pulp wood from private city, county, and tribal and state trust lands. For the past few years, Rainier's provided access for research for rare butterflies, dense surveys for the reintroduced fisher, U.S. Forest Service inventories, and a study for ocean-derived nutrients for songbirds. All of that's being conducted on Rainier lands, along with traditional silvicultural and genetics research. They're also entering into their 15th year of the wildlife plan in conjunction with the Department of Fish and Wildlife to provide dispersal habitat for the spotted owl of 65,000 acres near Forks. Next week, the Quileute Tribe, the Ho Tribe, and Rainier will do their annual seed and bark pull to collect bark from Rainier trees for tribal weavers so they can use and pass on their weaving tradition to the next generation. So a lot is going on in the forest made possible by the retention of working forests through sustainable harvest of timber products. Rainier, again, can't be here today and wants to, me to personally thank the board for allowing us to present this information as they're conducting their 10th annual third-party audit through the Sustainable Forestry Initiative. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Cindy. Peter Goldman. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Commissioner. Good morning, Board. I'm Peter Goldman of the Washington Forest Law Center, representing the Conservation Caucus, and I'd like to address two issues, please. The first is just more of a heads up than anything else, and the second is about biomass. The first is about water typing. Through a series of forest practice applications, we came across a situation in which, because we're in two different water typing systems right now, it's very complicated. It appears that type 3 waters, which do contain fish, may not be being treated as fish streams under the forest practice rules with respect to off-channel habitat connected to those streams. Last week, we sent a 5-page letter to DNR and stakeholders. I apologize, it appears that we did not share with the board, but everybody else got a copy of our letter. But there, for some of you who have been on the board, you might remember the situation. Forest and Fish provided protection for all fish-bearing streams. But we didn't 100% implement the type, the new Forest and Fish stream process because we are still in the interim stream process for a variety of reasons. But as a result of that being in both systems at the same time, it appears that off-channel habitat, which is so important for fish, is not being protected in the case of off-channel habitat connected to type 3 streams as opposed to type 2 streams, the big waters. So we have an issue which is before DNR, and I'm sure DNR will get back to us soon on this, or will be reporting to the board on this, but there is something that we believe that DNR can resolve and can resolve to find that type 3 was intended to be protected by type 2. The board did indicate that type F, fish-bearing streams, includes both type 2 and 3. Or DNR could say that it needs additional guidance from the board, at which time this board would get involved. But we're just asking for the board to follow through with the commitment and Forest and Fish is to protect all type F habitat and its related off-channel habitat. On biomass, I'd like to thank Bridget Moran for doing an excellent job bringing all the stakeholders together to talk about what we need for biomass rulemaking phase 2. We've had 2 meetings and other ones in next month, and Bridget just released last week a pretty ambitious plan over the next year to address forest biomass collaboratively, and we look forward to doing that. The Conservation Caucus has submitted 2 technical papers so far on what we need to look at in the forest in terms of where we can get the biomass from and where we need to leave it, and how much we can take and how much we can must leave. That has mostly been in the context of the supply study that DNR has commissioned. But anyway, we're working well there. We do want to make one point, though, that this board needs to know how much biomass is coming off of private land in the interim. Can we wait a year? Are there any interim measures that we need to account for in the meantime? We do know that a relatively small amount is coming off of state land, but private land we really don't know. And I think to give us the comfort that we can take a year to figure out what rules, if any, we need, we should have some kind of assessment of what's coming off private land and any problems that we've had administering, so we can address those before there's environmental injury. Thank you. Thank you, Peter.
Carol Whitaker. Good morning, Carol.
Hey, Commissioner. Good morning, board members. I'm Cara Whitaker. I'm the staff scientist and policy analyst at the Washington Forest Law Center. And at your last meeting, you received a report on the progress made by the Northern Spotted Owl implementation team. And that included a draft work plan for implementing the recommendations of the Northern Spotted Owl Policy Working Group. You may recall that those recommendations were based primarily on voluntary incentives that are expected to result in a strategic contribution from non-federal lands towards the conservation of a viable population of spotted owls in Washington. This topic is not on today's agenda, but it must remain on your radar. A recent meta-analysis by Forestman et al. Showed that spotted owl populations in Washington state have declined by 40 to 60% during the last 15 plus years. And they specifically warn that the number of populations that have declined and the rate of decline on study areas in Washington are noteworthy and should be cause for concern for the long-term sustainability of spotted owl populations throughout the range of the subspecies. Time is of the essence for effective conservation of threatened and endangered species. To help ensure consistent and timely progress of the important work of the Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Team, I urge you to direct the team to report to you at each of your regular meetings. Thank you.
Thank you. Peter Heide. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Commissioner. And thank you to the board for allowing me to speak this morning. My name is Peter Heide with the Washington Forest Protection Association, and I will be, I think, quite brief. Mr. Goldman mentioned some concerns about water typing and portrayed them in a way that seemed quite simple, and I think I would have to say that I don't believe they are simple. And in fact, the discussion about off-channel habitat and associated wetlands was not part of forest and fish, but it was carried over from earlier rules that were put in place in the early 90s, maybe late 80s even. I've been trying to figure that out. But they result from a series of papers that came out of the University of Washington and other places by Phil Peterson, Leslie Reed, who were the authors, worked on work from Jeff Cederholm, who's a former DNR employee and fish biologist, who was looking at the major river systems on the west slope of the west side of the Olympic Peninsula, and found that these old oxbows and various other features of wide, large floodplains were creating or were part of excellent habitat for rearing coho salmon and other anadromous fish. And so in the early 90s, those aspects were added to the forest practices rules. And when forest and fish came along, there was a lot of concern about, primarily from the tribes, that we weren't going to continue that protection. And so we just simply took the same language from the previous rules. And I think the way the DNR is currently interpreting these, the current rule, is correct, that these are the larger river systems that provide this major off-channel and waters. When they say off-channel, we don't mean out of the channel. We mean smaller channels adjacent to the large streams. So a number of research projects on this topic that I'd be looking at, and I look forward to the opportunity to discuss this. I think it ought to be part of the forest and fish policy work, since the policy committee is been asked to help interpret the rules. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you. Sean Cantrell. Morning, Sean.
Good morning. Good morning, board. My name is Sean Cantrell. I'm with Seattle Audubon Society, and I just wanted to touch briefly on the same topic that Cara had mentioned, the Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Team. As you recall, this group is looking at ways to implement measures, including incentive-based systems, to improve non-federal land contributions to conservation of the Northern Spotted Owl. I want to just remind this board that the federal government is currently revising the recovery plan for the OWL, including updating modeling for non-federal lands. So I urge you to make sure that this issue doesn't slip away. Similar to what Cara said, I think if every board meeting includes a specific staff report, you receive a lot of other staff reports. So just encourage you to ask the staff, both DNR and WFW help staff this. Conservation groups, industry are on the implementation team. And my concern, frankly, is that this issue has a tendency to slip to the background until a crisis hits. Whether it be that a lawsuit or new recovery plan rules or critical habitat designation changes, I just encourage you to get the implementation team to be ahead of the curve instead of reacting afterwards. Again, I think there's positive energy on the recovery, on the implementation team, and that there's a real promise there. This board adopted or endorsed the recommendations back in February of 2010. But my fear is that this will just kind of slip to the background until there's a crisis, and crisis management's no fun. So let's deal with this more upfront. So including this as your regular updates will help spur those of us on the implementation team to get progress every 3 months, if not before. Thank you.
Thank you. So that concludes this opportunity for comment from the public. Moving on to staff reports, I want to remind the board that hopefully you've all had a chance to look and study your packets carefully. That's where the staff reports are. As a change in routine now, from this point forward, instead of having really brief reports, we're going to ask if there's if any members have questions from the staff, and they're all present here that have written these reports relative to these areas, Clean Water Act assurances, and so on, to try and keep the meeting as brief as possible. Again, if you have questions on the staff reports, now is the time to ask that question. Anna.
Commissioner, I had a request that it's going to be unusual, but for this instance, if David Whipple could come up and give a very brief update on the upland wildlife component. We've done a little bit more thinking on the bald eagle rule change and how that might impact.
Since this report was written,
yes.
Perhaps?
Yes.
Of course.
So that I think that would be beneficial.
As long as it's brief. This is less than an hour, right, Dave?
Run.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Yes.
I have a question relative to the Clean Water Act assurance.
Okay, we'll get to that as well.
Okay, I didn't know if you wanted to go in order as they are in this.
Well, the guy's up here already.
Yeah, that's funny. I don't want to hear it. Go back.
Just real briefly, my name is David Whipple, I'm the Forest Policy Coordinator for Fish and Wildlife Department. The staff report alludes to changes that have taken place on the bald eagle protection front. And I wanted to make sure that folks had the chance to ask questions, but also to tell the board that we're working very hard on kind of two phases to solving the issue. The Fish and Wildlife Commission basically changed our WACs. We will no longer be issuing bald eagle management plans as of sometime later this month when the rules go into effect. The Washington RCW still protect the bald eagle, but we're shifting our emphasis and our workload to other pressing duties because of the recovery of the species, and we're going to be deferring, in essence, to the Fish and Wildlife Service and their protection guidelines under the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act. And so that causes an issue for the Forest Practices Rules in that if a landowner is going to propose harvest that would normally be classified as a Class 4 special because of proximity to eagles, they would do a bald eagle plan with us that gets them out of that SEPA trigger and they move forward as they would normally. Because we're not writing plans anymore, that creates a kind of a you can't get there from here scenario. So what we're proposing to do, and I've had conversations with some of the stakeholders, is instead of using the Bald Eagle Management Plan to get landowners out of SEPA, basically, for eagles, we're proposing to direct the landowners to the Fish and Wildlife Services process, and they have a very simplified website, web-based process, to get a get the guidelines or an actual take permit from the feds. And if they're able to do that, then that would qualify in our interpretation as a special wildlife management plan, which is another mechanism to keep forest landowners from triggering class 4 special for eagles. So basically the special wildlife management plan, or SWAMP, SWMP, would suffice and take the place of a bald eagle management plan, and that would be the phase one. Phase two would be a permanent change to the forest practices rules, which we would hope to get the wildlife work group back together, because the bald eagle's on the wildlife work plan that the board has, and hopefully at the next meeting request the board to initiate rulemaking on bald eagles. So it's a two-phased approach. We think we've got phase one figured out. We've got some details to work out on implementation, but that's the direction we're going. And we will regroup on a permanent rule change. So I wanted to make sure that everybody kind of knew that we've got a plan, and we've got some logistics to work out, but we think it's doable.
All right. Norm?
A couple questions, Dave, just for clarification, if I can. You indicated that the landowner could go to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and if I heard this right, for either management guidelines or an incidental take permit.
Right.
And if one elected the incidental take permit, I guess it's an election, I'm not sure how that works, where that choice is made, as opposed to the management guidelines, what is the process and procedure for that? Is it, I mean, is this a multiple year thing to get an incidental take permit and through the federal process, as opposed to simply following the guidelines?
The way that I understand it, and I don't understand it completely, but if you go to the website and you look at the guidelines and you as a landowner determine that you can live with those, you would print off that page, sign and date it, and for the state you'd be done with the feds. For the state, you'd submit it with your FPA, we would concur with that, and you would go forward. If you needed to depart from those guidelines for whatever reason, or wanted to, you can talk to the feds and they can say, yes, we still think that is not going to result in a take. You're good to go, basically. If they believe a take would occur, and that is kind of the old-fashioned normal definition of you're going to cut down a nest tree all the way to disturbance, they would issue a take permit for that. I don't know what the timeline is on that, but there's a specified amount and level of take that they're allowed to permit throughout the whole region, Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, on an annual basis. So I don't think it's going to be a huge deal. It's not going to ATP where it's going to take a year or two. It's more of a consultation process and say, this is what we're going to do. We think you're going to cause this much take. Here's your take permit.
I appreciate very much that the Wildlife Work Group is looking for solutions that specifically address forest practices. Thank you for that.
All right. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Norm, you had another question on CWAs?
Yes. Yes, so this is for Mark Hicks, I believe, then.
You get the full team.
Wow.
Yeah.
Bonus round. On page 4 of your report, at the very top, this is under the CEMER research milestones.
Yes.
The first one in 2010, mass wasting prescription scale monitoring. Your milestone not met, and you indicate that there's a degree of conflict and dispute resolution process may be necessary. I'd just like some explanation to the board on what's being done, because obviously this is a big issue and it shows up on a number of different things down below, that this may be holding up other necessary milestones. So
it is a big issue, and unfortunately when one has to submit things to the board in advance, things change over time too. It looks to me like that CEMER has kind of ironed out the differences at this point, and it'll move forward to ISBR. So it's taken a little longer, but based on my understanding today, that project is moving forward to the formal ISPR review.
Okay.
So, and that would be true with a few items here where things have been resolved that were pointed out as a potential problem.
Good. So we're maybe back on track?
Okay. Well, we're back on a track.
A track.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you for that. I'm encouraged that it's moved on.
Yeah, me too.
Finally.
Mayor, sure, if I may, I just wanted to reiterate to the board that the Clean Water Act milestones are not only about meeting commitments under the Forest and Fish Report, but it's also lined up with our settlement agreement with EPA and the plaintiffs under the TMDL lawsuit in 1998. And sometime in the future, we'll come back to you and ask for some agenda time to explain that further.
You come, what is it, annually you come to, with a more lengthy review?
Well, we have started that trend. I think for the August meeting, we'll provide a longer conversation.
So that's going to be your annual report, so to speak?
Yeah.
Great.
Sherry. Don't run off yet.
I'm sorry. Sherry had a question for you.
Don't run off yet.
Almost made it. Yeah,
that's close.
Page 2, down at the very bottom, it said that one of the milestones is develop a plan for evaluating the risk posed by SFL on roads.
Yes.
And an ecology provided suggested approach, but no action has occurred. I'm kind of would like some more clarity on what that approach was.
Oh, I'd be happy to send it to you as well, but it was just a way to use available resources, available staff resources, to over a period of several years collect the information needed to do a reasonable job at assessing current conditions of small forest landowner roads, as opposed to making it a separate standalone project that, you know, would be essentially like a CEMA research project kind of that required extra funding, just looking for a way to get the work done, recognizing we keep having reduced funding to get the job done, all these jobs done. And since that time, as most of you or all of you know, we've had further reductions in staff and further projected reductions in budgets. And it's getting really tough to find even the idea of trying to put a de minimis increase in staff time in to collect additional information is one that bristles.
So what, you're taking this off the FPAs? That's where you're going to get the information?
No, this would have been an actual field visit.
Oh.
But not a senior study.
Not a senior study. So, and I'd be happy to share that with you. But it was just an effort on ecology's part not to kind of leave this all as kind of bring me a rock kind of things, as to make some suggestions as the rock might look like this. You know, this might be one way to do it, and that's what this was. This was essentially saying, here's one way that might get this job done. And
my bigger concern is 2018. You know.
Yes.
We've got to start making some progress on this issue.
Paula?
So this may be a topic for a longer discussion in August, but I'd like to hear your answer now. Are we getting close to the point where Clean Water Act assurances are going to be endangered again because of budget cuts and lack of progress on these milestones?
Well, that's the conversation that we need to have, and it's a very important and delicate one that we're going to have internally over the summer, and in preparation for a meeting in August. And we want to do that as carefully and deliberately as we possibly can.
And I just want to reiterate, I mean, what is being talked about here is real. Every day, the real challenge for agencies during this period of time is to try and follow through on a work plan that was developed some years ago that was done with the thinking that the budget would not be a constraint. And the budget, quite frankly, is a huge constraint these days. So this is not the only place where an anticipated work program has to look carefully at what is realistic, given the reset that we've all gone through.
Right, and ecology is very sympathetic to that, and that's part of what will have to go into the thinking over the next few months.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions from the board on the staff reports? All right, thank you. Moving on then. The next item on this morning's agenda is a legislative activity report from Darren. Morning, Darren.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Darren Kramer, Forest Practices Division Manager.
The commissioner talked about a couple of pieces of legislation. I'll try to fill in some of the details on those, as well as talk about one other. You notice that it's down to one page from six that we had in February. So that's in some ways, a good sign. We have two bills that have passed, and the first one was already mentioned. That's House Bill 1509, which is the PrEP bill. Signed on the 28th of April by the governor, effective July 1. So some of the provisions of this bill defines a qualifying small forest landowner as a for-profit entity, meeting the small forest landowner criteria that are currently in the rule. Expands the definition of qualifying timber that's eligible for an easement to include timber on potentially unstated slopes. However, limits compensation for that timber to $50,000 in any biennial funding period. It requires the Small Forest Landowner Office, subject to available funding, to utilize no more than 50% of the funds to determine the value of the cube, basically. And this was an attempt to get at that issue of lost value over time from applicants sitting in the queue for some period of time before we can actually go out and value the timber due to fire, due to wind, a variety of factors. So this was an attempt to get the timber valued as quickly as possible. It changes the starting date of a 50-year easement to the time when an application is considered complete. So that's when harvest has been done and an applicant submits their harvest status questionnaire. It requires DNR, expands the authority of DNR to reimburse landowners for the cost associated with preparing an easement, and requires DNR to submit to the governor before November 1st of each even-numbered year a list of all easements to be funded. And along with that, we have to include things like the date of the easement application, maps, estimated value, et cetera. And this is to form the basis for a capital funding request from the governor to the legislature. It requires DNR to collect full reimbursement from a funded easement when a landowner sells the property associated with an easement to a non-qualifying landowner within the first 10 years of compensation. And directs the chair of the board to put together a stakeholder group to deal with the long-term funding issue and make a report to the legislature by May 2012 about that issue. So that's PrEP. The other bill that has passed is House Bill 1582. This was a bill requested by WASAC and has to do with forest practices leading to conversion of land for development purposes. Basically what this does is it removes the phrases lands platted after January 1, 1960 and lands that have or are being converted from the statute defining classifications of forest practices, and replaces that with the simple statement forest lands that are being converted to another use. And what this does is it gets those folks that are continuing to practice forestry but have platted lands out of the Class 4 general trigger. So if you happen to be somewhere where the land was platted prior to or after January 1, 1960, and you want to continue to practice forestry, your application will be classified accordingly, 2, 3, 4, whatever it happens to be, but you're not automatically thrown into the Class 4 general bucket whereby you have to do CEQA. That's basically the gist of the legislation. The one bill that the chair also mentioned, 5862, still kicking around over in the legislature, and very much in flux, so I'm not going to go through all the details because they certainly could change, but some of the provisions are generally summarized here on your sheet. The board shall incorporate by reference into the rules those fish protection requirements in Chapter 222.110 that are applicable to forest practices. Board shall establish and maintain guidance to help implement those rules. As the chair mentioned, integrates hydraulic project approvals into forest practices applications for all hydraulic projects associated with forest practices, and DNR would assume approval disapproval authority for those. However, DFW retains authority to manage and protect the state's fish resources, basically set the standards for those rules. and shall review and provide comments on DNR high priority forest practices hydraulic projects. And the DNR is directed to incorporate those recommendations into FPA approvals. Review period for FPAs associated with those types of projects extended out to 45 days from 30. And as the commissioner mentioned, a revised fee schedule is included for FPAs that raises the fees, creates an account whereby those fees are deposited for the sole purpose of implementing the acting rules. That's a summary of where it stands today. It certainly could change by the next board meeting if it even still exists. That's my report on ledge activity.
Board still exists.
Pardon?
Board still exists.
That's not what I meant.
Questions from board members?
And Darren, just to be clear, the two ones that did pass do require rulemaking.
These all would, the two that did pass do require rulemaking. They're both effective July 1 of this year. Mm-hmm. And certainly if the integration bill passes, it would also require. So we do have another heavy rulemaking workload coming up in the next biennium. Other questions? Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Darren. So we're making good progress this morning. We're not going to take a break now. Moving on then, the low impact template. Mark? Morning, Mark.
Morning, Chair and members of the board. I'm Mark Engel. Ken kind of created some high expectations for my report to the board. It's important to keep this topic on the board agenda. However, we're still working on the template. A brief background. In December of last year, small forest landowners brought a template before the Small Forest Lander Advisory Committee. Stakeholders were invited to listen to the proposal, and as a result of that, the state caucus agreed to take the kind of the general parameters that were presented in the template, and then to develop a template from which we could bring back to stakeholders as it was a really good starting point. We're still working on that template. It has been a little bit slower than we had anticipated, we had the holidays and then the challenges of ledge session and all of the other work that's before us. So the good news is that the template is continuing to be worked on. We do intend to present it to stakeholders as soon as it's completed. The Small Forest Landowner Advisory Committee has scheduled their next meeting for June 8th, and we're hoping to bring the template to them. Again, I emphasize hoping, but there is progress being made. And we will maintain this agenda on the boards, you know, at each board meeting, this topic. And we definitely want the board to hear what's going on with the template. So do you have any questions?
Questions? Sherry?
Is the state caucus meeting?
We were meeting very frequently. Now it's more, it's not as frequent. We do have another meeting scheduled on the 16th. So
Of May.
So as I, if my dates are right, I believe that's next Monday. And we'll continue to schedule meetings as soon as we can thereafter.
Getting close, though, just
we
as far away, right?
We're getting very close.
Please continue your hard work.
I want to assure you that they're working hard on this.
Mm-hmm, cool.
Other questions from the board? All right. Thank you very much for that report. And we're hopeful that there at our next meeting it can be there can be more
progress.
In depth progress on this. So the next item on this morning's agenda is a Forest Practices Compliance Action Plan update.
Morning again.
This is the board, Darren Kramer, Forest Practices Division Manager. You have in your packet a memo from myself and Julie summarizing what we intend to do to respond to the blind spotting results issue. We see the presentation on in February. The areas that we are going to focus on are water type classification determinations, riparian non-compliance, riparian 20-acre exempt non-compliance, road non-compliance, and type A wetland non-compliance. That sounds like just about everything in the report, but it's not quite everything. It's what we determined should be the priority focus areas. So if you recall on the water type classification, while a compliant, non-compliant call was not made on these, the field crews did note when there appeared to be an inconsistency with what they observed on the ground versus what was on the application, and or if there was incomplete information on the application. And there were quite a few cases where that occurred. In particular, approximately 24% of NP waters observed on the ground appeared to meet the physical criteria for an F, and the crews could not tell from looking at the application and the materials associated with that application how the water type was specifically determined. So in order to get on top of that, Julie's going to help me out, keep me on track here. We're going to be updating the program's website. This has come up in the past, and we have been working on this. This is about putting how-to guidance on the website for applicants to follow when they come across a situation that doesn't quite fit with what's written in the rule book. How do you implement the rule in this situation? Those sorts of things. So we've been working on this for some time. We just haven't quite got over the finish line and got it up on the website, but that's certainly our intent, and we will be doing that. We are also developing an external website for the water type modification review process. So this will create a more transparent process that anybody could access, as well as a more efficient process rather than the paper process we have right now. And then taking that information and loading it into FPAR so that it's available. Once a water type modification form has gone through the process, that information will be available and linked to the base maps in FPARs. So these are all things that obviously have at least some sort of IT component, and we have to work not only with our IT folks, but our information technology division. And we've got some capacity constraints there, and that's been limiting our ability to get this done quickly, but we have been working on it and hope to have that done before the end of the fiscal year. One of the most important things we're going to do is focus on ensuring that applicants have complete information with regard to water typing on their FPA. There is check boxes and information boxes for applicants to fill out, as well as a worksheet that's associated with the FPA, whereby applicants can demonstrate how they verified water types. We were missing the mark occasionally on ensuring that those were complete. And so we're focusing on making sure that happens in the future. And then to follow up, we're going to do a special emphasis sampling through compliance monitoring, basically a repeat, a focus sample similar to what was done for some of the topic areas this last round, and get that feedback back to the program and to you early next year, so that we'll only have about a year in between when we start this effort and when we'll get feedback about how it's working. So that's our intent on water typing. On riparian non-compliance, if you recall, the compliance ratings ranged from 74% to 78% between small and larges, respectively, with an average of about 77%. The entire range across all riparian types of activities and all landowners ranged from 50 to 97%. So there was quite a range depending on the type of choice that landowners made with regard to what type of riparian option they're going to go with. However, the rules are complex, site conditions highly variable, so it's difficult for the compliance monitoring crews to determine exact reasons for why some of those non-compliant some of those activities were non-compliant. But certainly something that jumped out was the differences in measuring stream length that were noted on applications versus what the field crews were estimating. So we think that's one area that could take care of quite a few of these issues for both Fs and NPs. So we're going to develop specific guidance, both operationally and for the board manual, on how to measure stream length. This is not a new issue. We've known about this for some time. We just haven't gotten to it. Certainly, these results raises this on the priority list to get taken care of. And then again, follow that up with a special emphasis sampling this season with feedback early next year on how that is working. On the 20-acre exempt apps, this was one of our lower compliant ratings at about 62%. We think this is probably due to just lack of familiarity with the regulations. Typically, these landowners harvest maybe once in their ownership of the parcel. So, probability of problems is probably high in that kind of situation when you have people that aren't familiar with the rules and they only harvest once or twice. So what we're going to do to address this is add a condition on the approval of 20-acre exempt apps that requires notification to the department within 48 hours before operations commence, which will help us be efficient in on-the-ground tracking and technical assistance for those folks. We're going to ask our foresters to visit those applications at least twice during their life of operations and continue conducting compliance monitoring surveys on those applications. While some new work, we think this is manageable because the frequency of 20-acre exempt apps is relatively low. So we think we can take care of this with our existing capacity. On road non-compliance, again, ranged from 77% for large landowners to 84% for small landowners. And this is another area where the crews were not able to precisely determine what was contributing to the non-compliance. Therefore, we're going to try to address this programmatically. And we've already been doing quite a few of these things, but we're going to put more emphasis on it and expand it a bit. Certainly at regional TFW meetings, we've been talking about this with landowners and operators that show up, as well as with our staff. We're going to continue to do that. We recently restarted up our training to the Washington Contract Loggers Association. We started doing that last fall after about a year and a half hiatus. And we're getting some real good bang for the buck there, so we're going to continue doing that. We're going to develop and have been working on developing some program guidance on enforcement action decisions and documentation, particularly with regard to roads and sediment delivery, making that process more clear for our own staff. Certainly continue to emphasize close working relationship with ecology on these issues. You'll hear a little bit more about the RMAP operational plan later today, and we're going to focus on implementing that. And continue compliance surveys of roads to determine if these things are making a difference in overall compliance ratings. On the Type A wetlands, this one's a bit different than the others in that we had pretty low sample size, but it was interesting in that we had 3 of 8 small landowners that missed the mark on this, and we had about a 63% compliance rate on that. Type A wetlands, sometimes difficult to identify and in different situations, so certainly could be understandable that small landowners that don't harvest it off as often may have difficulty interpreting the rules with regard to these wetlands. So we're going to continue working on this through, similar to roads, through our TFW regional meetings with landowners, operators, and our own staff. That's going to prove to be a bit difficult in getting, I think, reaching out to small landowners, because I don't think we get a huge amount of participation at the TFW meetings. But we do think we get some bang for the buck with the Contract Loggers Association on this front. They often work for small landowners. So we're going to continue to incorporate that training into our program and focus a bit more on wetland identification as part of that training. And follow this up with an emphasis sample similar to the other two I mentioned previously to see if we are making some improvements there. Along with our efforts to focus on improving compliance in these different topic areas, we need to take and are taking a hard look at our overall program. We're continuing to be challenged by resource constraints, as you have heard. And while this is certainly a very valuable program and required for us to do, it's very expensive and time-consuming. And we're going to need to figure out if we can do it as effectively at lower cost than what we're spending today. So that's something I've taken on, and we'll be working with Walt and the program to figure out if there's ways we can do that, while still ensuring we get good, rigorous results using meaningful and fair methods, but trying to lower the overall cost. We certainly have some things on our wish list if and when our resource constraints begin to relax. These are things that we've had to significantly reduce over the past couple of years, but in my view make a huge difference in compliance and program effectiveness. And that's training. We have a very minimal level of training support for our own folks as well as stakeholders. It's been 10 years since we've done comprehensive training across the rules, particularly the rules that came into effect in 2001, and it's been 4 years since we've spent any comprehensive effort at all on our own staff. So that's on the top of my list to add capacity or certainly restore if and when we have the opportunity. Following that up with clear and consistent and constant communication is also important. Julie was just telling me yesterday that we have a couple of three-ring binders full of issue papers and guidance for the program, just for the rules that have been in place since 2001. And no wonder it's hard for people to recall all the details all the time. So we need to reinforce that with training and communication, and we just haven't been doing a very good job there. We haven't been able to do a very good job there. But we are going to focus on these high-priority topic areas and try to make some difference there going forward. And as I mentioned, our staff resources are limited. We do the best we can. We don't have enough people to visit every site as often as we would like to, nor do we have enough folks in our region support section in the division to help the regions out in implementing the rules. So if and when we are able to, that's another area of focus for restoring some capacity in the future. That concludes my report. I'm sure there's questions. I'd be happy to take them.
Sherry?
I have a couple questions. Well, actually, comment on 20-acre exempt folks. I think you're dead right on when you say that this is actually a contract law issue.
And I would appreciate any other advice I might be able to get from you on how best to reach those folks.
That's a good question. Maybe I'll give Jerry a call, but you know, it's the loggers that actually go out there and do the services. It's not really the landowner. Oftentimes they won't even know that the unit's going on or when it's going on. So the focus should really be directed at the loggers, but not so much the landowners.
We've been getting excellent participation from those folks at these trainings. We had two, and at the one we just had about a month or so ago, I think we had over 75 contract loggers there.
Yeah, my husband goes to them. Okay. Kind of those reports. You're kicking up a real bee's nest, you know, at the local level. Your foresters are taking their physical characteristics to really an extreme as far as making that call. So I would just caution that you have a discussion and training with your foresters, your field foresters, the ones that go out on the ground, you know, to be accurate, not to go overboard. But I'm getting some really bad phone calls about how the field foresters are just out of control.
Well, I'd certainly be interested in more details there, if you wouldn't mind sharing them with me.
I will, on a personal level.
Okay.
Yes, Anna?
First of all, Darren, I wanted to thank you and the commissioner for making this a priority and giving us this draft plan. I think what I'm concerned, and I know I raised this last Friday too, Darren, what I'm concerned the most about is just for almost all of these, it seems like the reasons for noncompliance is still, we still don't really know a lot about that. And I very much understand the resource constraints you're under and can empathize with that. But I'm just wondering if there's an opportunity to you know, I would certainly volunteer Fish and Wildlife to participate in some kind of a technical meeting to talk about ways to, you know, maybe we do more than just an annual reporting. Is there ways to look at, as we're going, more in-depth analysis of why we don't know whether compliance is being met or not?
And that's, well, not written down here, certainly our staff, and I'm sure the folks that participate with our compliance staff know that this is a concern. That just reporting
it's
is
kind
great.
Of an underlying.
We need to try to get our arms around what might be contributing. And we are thinking about that, and the field crews are aware of that, and making notes on their field forms where they can, where it looks obvious or where there's some indication of a cause. They are going to do that, and will do that more in the future. But again, it's the trade-off between getting the actual work of measuring compliance done versus trying to determine what caused the non-compliance. We could focus a lot of effort there and not do very much by way of measuring compliance. So we got to try to figure out a good balance between the two, and we are going to do that. One of the things we are talking about is how we might follow up with operators or landowners after the fact, perhaps, see if we can get some information about what might have contributed, whether it's lack of understanding or whether, you know, didn't see the tags, whatever the case might be. Again, that's going to be driven by do we have the time and people to do that, because that could be quite a bit of process time, meeting time, et cetera. So we are going to focus more on it in the future to try to figure out what's going on, but I think we will always be limited given our current capacity, basically having two people here that focus on compliance monitoring and then relying on the help of all stakeholders to get the job done at the field. Did you have anything?
Dorn? On a partial answer to your question, from a practical standpoint on the part of at least our company as landowner, one of the things that we've determined is that we need to document a whole lot better, whether that goes into the application or just simply sits in our box. For example, how we measured or where we measured stream width. Is it over 10 feet or under 10 feet? And actually mark that in the field so that if compliance monitoring goes back out there in the same place, they at least can measure the same locations that we did, and hopefully they would come up with the same result at those locations. But if we measured in one place and they measured in a different place, it's going to come up with a different result, no matter what. So that's one of the simple things, but it does require a lot of extra work on our part, but hopefully to try to resolve some of that interpretation issue that existed in the report. So hopefully that will help in some respects. That's not a requirement in the rules. It's just something that we're taking on ourselves so that we don't find ourselves in a situation of difference of opinion just on simple parameters of measurement. Darren and Julie, I do have another question. One of the things that I've heard is